Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we want to discuss some free speech legislation that's being discussed in the state. It has to do with something that goes by the acronym SLAPP, S-L-A-P-P, Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. In other words, as one person put it very simply, it's a way the powerful have of getting unhappy, less powerful people to just be quiet. Now, Iowa is one of just a few states, 17 states, that doesn't have anti-SLAPP legislation. That's according to the Public Participation Project, a coalition seeking to pass federal legislation. Let's lay some groundwork, understand this better, by talking first with David Walker. He's a retired Drake University law professor and chair of the Iowa Commission on Uniform Laws. David, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Ben.
Okay, I gave a very brief introduction about this, but let's start by having you explain a little bit more about the type of lawsuits this legislation would address.
Well, it does address lawsuits that are designed primarily not to seek relief, but to get someone to stop exercising, whether it's a right of free speech, as you mentioned, or other rights, a right of petition to the government for favorable action, whether it's an assembly right or, of course, freedom of the press, as the Carroll County Times case involved. So that these lawsuits began to manifest themselves in the late 1980s, and the ones not seeking really relief as much to stymie or cancel someone's public expression.
You referred to that Carroll case, and I want to go to a Des Moines Register editorial to kind of remind our listeners what this was about. And just reading from the editorial in the Des Moines Register, in 2018, a Carroll police officer sued the Carroll Times-Herald over its reporting on his sexual relationships with two teenagers and his previous firing from Sumner's the police department, in part because of inappropriate Facebook messages sent to a teen, clearly a matter of public concern, according to this editorial. So in this case, help us understand, this suit was filed to just keep this newspaper quiet or keep it from reporting more on this?
Well, there were the suit was a defamation suit. It may also have had other theories supporting it. It was clearly designed to stop the publication and stop any further attention to the lawsuit, because in time, the plaintiff admitted that the reporting was true, and the trial court found that there wasn't a genuine issue of material fact on that point. What the newspaper had printed was the truth. There had been not only flirtation, there had been the previous undisclosed dismissal, and there had been, you know, relationships which, for a policeman in a community with teenage young women, were inappropriate. So, and yet that lawsuit went on for some 14 to 15 months and cost the Carroll County Times, as I recall, something like $140,000 above and beyond its insurance limits. Other suits have been similarly designed to stop attention, you know, stop someone from going forward with the exercise of public expression.
These meritless defamation claims seeking to use the courts to silence critics, how much of a history do they have in the U.S.?
There are numerous cases across the country. Sometimes the speaker is on the left, sometimes the speaker is on the right. In this past legislative session, for example, one of the persons most powerfully advocating the legislation was a uniform law commissioner from Indiana, Jim Bopp, who's heralded as one of the foremost conservative lawyers in the country. He's the architect for Citizens United. He wrote an amicus brief in Dobbs versus Mississippi. And it's not a partisan issue, but because it is across the spectrum of trying to silence speakers and exercise of those core First Amendment rights.
When did this start becoming a problem in the U.S.? Has it been a problem for a long time?
It's an interesting question because in a lot of cases where the slap suit or the threat of it is successful, we'll never know whether someone forbeared from filing a publication or further petitioning or assembling because he didn't want to incur the expense or he didn't have the time or he simply worried about it. But as evidenced over more than 30 states or jurisdictions, because the Virgin Islands and Guam have also enacted DC as well, you know, it came to people's attention that this was something for which we had to stand up, the exercise of the rights guaranteed to us under the United States and state constitutions protecting public expression.
So this legislation, and we can talk about how far it's gone in the Iowa legislature, but this is the Uniform Public Expression Protection Act, or House File 456, helping to protect the right to expression regarding public concerns. Go through the points quickly of what this bill contains.
Right. It has five essential features. And I'm going to mention them, and the question is a good one because while there are some 33 states or jurisdictions that have adopted anti-SLAPP legislation, the legislation varies. For example, in Pennsylvania, as I last recall, it only protected people speaking on environmental issues. In Nebraska, you know, for example, it only protects people who are appearing before a public body. In some states, you had to be seeking affirmative relief. House File 456 protects all of those, but also the exercise of those rights on matters of public interest, not private matters, public interest, public policy. Five features. One, it provides a procedure for bringing the issue to the court's attention and invoking its powers. We have civil rules of procedure. They are very good. But they don't specifically deal with this. And for example, they don't provide for the kind of stay of discovery that cost the Carroll County Times so much money over 15 months' time. It provides for, second, a stay of discovery while a motion to strike or motion to dismiss a claim, because it is barred by the First Amendment, it violates the First Amendment, is being raised. That would have kept the Carroll County publisher or editor-in-chief from depositions, from having to engage in all the, respond to all the civil discovery. You know, the third thing is it provides an expedited disposition framework. The motion to strike or dismiss has to be filed within 60 days. The court has to hold a hearing within 60 days of the motion. The court has to make a ruling within 60 days of the hearing. And finally, there is an automatic right of appeal in that. So that procedural framework is critical. The constitutional standards for striking, or the statutory standards for striking or dismissing a claim, are ones that have been applied in the federal courts for the last 80 years and Iowa for the last 50 years. There's no jury question. The province of the jury is not invaded. Finally, and essentially, there's a sanction for bringing a slap suit that a court finds should be stricken or dismissed. This dismissal is with prejudice. It can't be brought again. And the party prevailing on the motion, the little guy, to use your earlier terms, although in some cases the little guy might be National Public Radio, is entitled to reasonable attorney's fees and expenses. That sanction is going to keep a lot of people from filing so-called slap suits.
You mentioned this is a bipartisan issue. Getting this legislation has bipartisan support, I should say. Back up that claim and tell us a little bit more about how it is in the interests of all, no matter where you are in the political spectrum.
Sure. I mentioned not a partisan issue. You've got states in ranging from Arkansas and Texas and Alabama and Nebraska on the one hand to, you know, states like Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and Hawaii on the other hand. Within the state of Iowa, this last session, to the right, you had the Family Leader Foundation, Americans for Prosperity, and the Iowa Firearms Coalition, all speaking in favor of House File 456, as did Jim Bopp from Indiana on the other side. You've got the ACLU, the Iowa Association for Justice, the Attorney General, the Iowa Public Information Board, Iowa Broadcasters and Iowa Newspaper Associations, the ISBA, the Bar Association, and of course, the NAACP as well. These are not partisan issues. This is something that protects everyone's constitutional rights against being canceled on account of expense, protraction, delay, exhaustion.
And David, finally, before we say goodbye, we'll hear from an Iowa State representative. But I wanted to go in this direction. As you know, this has been passed by the House unanimously. It's stalled in the Senate the past couple of years. So if it's got broad bipartisan support, what has been holding it up here in Iowa?
I think there are one or possibly two people in the Senate Judiciary Committee on the Republican side who have persuaded the chairman, Brad Zahn, not to bring it to the agenda of the committee. And if it doesn't get to the agenda of the committee, it doesn't get out of committee, and it dies in what is called the funnel. And that is what has happened. I've had Jeff Reichman would have been the forum manager, 29-year Marine veteran. He said, you know, he never felt better than when he would the prospect of managing this bill. If it got to the floor, he knew what he'd been fighting for. And the previous session, a different floor manager, Republican, totally in favor of it. I'm told, I think there was a procedural mistake as to the timing of the funnel this year. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to not only pass it again in the House, but emerge from Senate Judiciary favorably, because there was no lobbyists declared against it. And there's broad national support and concern to have this kind of statement in our country.
Okay. David Walker, retired Drake University law professor, chair of the Iowa Commission on Uniform Laws. David, thank you so much.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, if you've been with us, we're discussing some free speech legislation that's being discussed in the state. It has to do with something that goes by the acronym SLAP, Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. Iowa is one of 17 states that doesn't have any anti-SLAP legislation. Let's get another perspective from Susan Patterson Plank. She's the Iowa Newspaper Association's executive director. Welcome to the program, Susan.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you, when did anti-SLAP legislation come to your association's attention?
We have been discussing and working on it probably the last 3 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And so what was there a point or an example that you saw, this is something we really need, that you can talk about?
Oh, sure. Yeah, probably the tipping point for us was what happened in Carroll, Iowa. That was really a moment where it was illustrated very clearly for our association and for our members how much was at risk if you were put in a situation where a lawsuit was being brought against you that was clearly being used for intimidation purposes. The risk to your business. And as an association, clearly we're interested in lots of things, but we're very interested in trying to keep our members financially stable, and that potentially has a huge impact on them.
So this legislation, how hopeful are you that it will be advanced further than it has in the past in the coming session?
Well, first of all, I'm an optimist, so I believe that it will get through. Getting legislation through, no matter what it is, takes time. And it takes time by design to make sure that the kinks are worked out, to make sure that anybody who has concerns understands what the issues are. And so the fact that it takes more than once is not discouraging. It's part of the process. And every year we get a little further down the line. So I am optimistic. And I think that there are different stories in Iowa and across the country that help illustrate the importance of this.
Susan, what do you feel are the major hurdles standing in the way of this legislation becoming law?
I think the biggest hurdle, frankly, is time. When you are trying to legislate, there's only so much time in the session, and there's lots of things for lots of people to get done. And so the fact that it takes more than one session to move something doesn't discourage me. It's just part of the process. We have to make sure that everybody who's involved and engaged understands what will happen and when the bill is passed. And so it's part of the process. You know, the other issue, people have concerns about who is it protecting and does it undermine the process of the court system. And so I think, you know, when people have a better understanding of how what actually happens if this bill moves forward, I think that we'll see positive things happen.
So, Susan, when we consider the type of media outlets this would impact or is impacting, are we talking larger sort of Gannett-type newspapers or family-owned newspapers across Iowa?
I appreciate you asking. Clearly, when a bill becomes law, it's going to protect everyone. It's going to protect big media companies. It's going to protect small companies. It's going to protect individual people. In Iowa, we have nearly 250 newspapers, and most of those are very, very small newspapers. 100 of the newspapers in the state of Iowa have fewer than 1,000 subscribers, and that's not because they're small newspapers. It's because they are in small, small communities, and they're mom-and-pop people, right? They're just like every other locally owned business on Main Street, and those are the people who are at the most risk of these types of lawsuits.
Right, and we know for years, because the business model has drastically changed, especially for new for small town newspapers, we're entering the we've entered the digital age, and so these smallest newspapers have been struggling. So you're saying this could be the difference between death and survival.
Anytime someone files a lawsuit, the cost of that lawsuit, whether it's for a locally owned newspaper or your favorite hairdresser, lawsuits are extremely costly. And if you are a locally owned business, sometimes that's going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Mm-hmm. And looking at those other states that perhaps have had this law in the books for years or some time at least, maybe you can give us your picture of the future, what difference it would make. Why should it matter to those listening whether this is passed or not?
Sure. You know, what it does is, you know, not only does it protect media outlets, it also protects individual people, right? So it stops lawsuits that are groundless and that are used for intimidation, right? And so we come at it from the perspective of newspapers or media outlets, but the reality is it protects anyone from those kinds of lawsuits where someone is trying to use their First Amendment right. So, you know, I think it's a bill and hopefully a law that doesn't get tapped very often, but when it does get tapped, it's very important.
All right. Thank you very much, Susan Patterson Plank, Iowa Newspaper Association's Executive Director. Thank you for giving us a little bit of your valuable time, Susan, to give us your view.
Thank you so much.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, finishing up a half hour discussing the problem of meritless defamation claims. These are claims that are really just seeking to use the courts to silence critics. Finally now, joined by Representative Stephen Holt. He's a Republican from Denison, also chair of the House Judiciary Committee in the Iowa Legislature. Representative Holt, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
This half hour, we've heard about this problem across the country, how over 30 states have enacted anti-SLAPP legislation. Again, that acronym, SLAPP, standing for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. Iowa is one of about 17 states that doesn't have any of those laws, and you support such legislation here in Iowa. When and how did this issue first get on your radar?
Well, thank you for a great question. I first began to hear about this issue probably in 2019 when I spoke to Doug Burns, who is with the Carroll newspaper, and I heard about what they went through, and very concerned about that, how that can affect our small town newspapers, our small town media. And so I contacted the Iowa Attorney General's office, worked with him, and his office came up with some language similar to what some other states have, California, for example. So I first introduced the legislation. It was House File 2339 in 2020 to try to deal with this issue. There were two key components in it. The first key component is creating a special motion to review these kinds of lawsuits so they could be dismissed toward the beginning. And then I think the second key, acting as a deterrent, is that the prevailing defendant is entitled to recover the costs and reasonable attorney fees. So that is a good deterrent to try to keep folks from filing these types of lawsuits. And so actually, I've had two pieces of legislation. We passed it nearly unanimously in the House. It was bipartisan because it is a bipartisan issue. So it passed unanimously or nearly unanimously in the House, didn't move forward in the Senate. And then we introduced a slightly different version of it in 2021, House File 456, using Professor Walker and the Uniform Code Commission language. And unfortunately, that one also did not move in the Senate. So we're going to continue to try.
We just spoke a few minutes ago with Susan Patterson-Plank, Iowa Newspaper Association Executive Director, and she mentioned that some legislators think this is all about protecting big media companies. Do you run into that as a misconception as well? Explain.
Well, I have, and I don't understand it. There's some that, frankly, on my side of the aisle, I suppose, in the Senate that have suggested it would protect CNN or something, and I don't understand it because, again, this is a bipartisan issue. It cuts both ways, whether you be someone with political leanings on the left or political leanings on the right. It would protect both sides from these type of lawsuits. And, you know, CNN and Fox News and all these folks have a cadre of lawyers and can certainly afford to deal with these sorts of things. When you get something like a small town newspaper left with $100,000 in debt, even though they won the lawsuit, that can put them out of business. And so this is who this is protecting. It's not really going to help CNN or Fox News, who can well afford to deal with these sorts of things. It's helping the smaller media in Iowa. So I definitely think it's something that we need to get done.
Okay, with this next round for the next legislative session in 2023, have there been tweaks to the bill? And what are you doing to just gain more support and make sure it doesn't die in the funnel?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, we have an election to win. We don't know who will be in the majority. Those sorts of things have to be done. But we've got two pieces of legislation that we've tried to advance, one in 2020, one in 2021, that are just fine. And so don't necessarily need to tweak the legislation. What we need to do is convince some folks in the Senate that this is not about protecting CNN or Fox News or any of those folks. It's about taking care of the smaller media in Iowa against these types of lawsuits that are really just intended to silence them. That would be very detrimental to our communities and to, you know, and to free speech and getting things that need to be known to the public out there. And so I'm going to continue to work on trying to convince folks that this is something that we need to do. Sometimes things take time, and we're going to keep at it.
And finally, Representative Holt, you're being heard right now by Iowans who, you know, don't own newspapers, small-town newspapers. They have small-town newspapers. What difference will it make to everyday Iowans?
Oh, absolutely. Well, everyday Iowans need to know what is going on in their communities. They need to know the truth. So this legislation would prevent, for instance, a newspaper like the Carroll newspaper from being bankrupted because they simply reported something that the public needed to know. And so it's very, very important from the perspective of a free people and having a free flow of information that these type of lawsuits not be used to put our small town newspapers out of business. So I think it's very important for them, for every citizen in Iowa, and for that matter across the country, that this type of lawsuit not be permitted to achieve its goals.
Okay, Representative Stephen Holt, a Republican of Denison, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Coming up after a short break, my conversation with theoretical physicist Sabina Hossenfelder. She's the author of a new book. It's called Existential Physics. And in it, she tackles some really big questions, such as, does the past still exist? How did the universe begin? How will it end? We'll tackle those questions after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we're going to tackle some really big questions. Get ready. I hope your brain's in shape for this. Big questions. Some of them you may have pondered, such as, how did the universe begin? When will it end? Does God exist? Other questions you may have never even considered, such as, does the past still exist? Or how about this one? Does the universe think? Well, my guest this half hour has thought deeply about these and many other big questions, and this is important in a scientific way. We spend this half hour with German theoretical physicist Sabine Hossenfelder. Hossenfelder is currently a research fellow at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies, where she leads the Superfluid Dark Matter Group. She's published more than 80 research articles. Really complicated stuff, foundations of physics, quantum gravity, dark matter, that kind of thing. But she has also written about physics for a broad audience, for the rest of us, so to speak, for many years. And she is the creator of the YouTube channel Science Without the Gobbledygook. And I just looked on that channel and watched a few episodes, over 500,000 subscribers at this time. Her latest book is titled Existential Physics, A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions. Joining us from Germany, Sabine Hossenfelder. Welcome to the program.
Hello, good to talk to you.
So first of all, before we dive into some of these questions you set out to answer, what did you set out to do overall in this book? Why did you write it?
I think a lot of people have a bad start with physics in school. They get to think it's just about how batteries work or planetary orbits, nuclear decay, that kind of thing. But I think physics is our best tool to find answers to the big questions, like why do we only get older and not younger? Are there other universes? Will we ever know everything? And many others.
Mm-hmm. You have a warning at the start of this book. I don't know if you have your book in front of you. I wonder either read a portion of that or just explain why you felt the need to have a warning. Of course, very few books have warnings at the start.
I do have the book here and I can read something if you want to.
Maybe that first paragraph or so?
Okay, sure. I want you to know what you're getting yourself into, so let me put my cards on the table up front. I'm both agnostic and a heathen. I've never been part of an organized religion and never felt the desire to join one. Still, I'm not opposed to religious belief. Science has limits, and yet humanity has always sought meaning beyond those limits. Some do it by studying holy scripture, some meditate, some dig philosophy, some smoke funny things. That's all fine with me, really. Provided that, and here's the crux, your search for meaning respects scientific fact.
And then you go on, one other sentence I want to add. If your belief conflicts with empirically confirmed knowledge, then you are not seeking meaning. You are delusional. Maybe you'd rather hold on to your delusions. Trust me, I am sympathetic to that, but then this book is not for you. That's the warning at the start of your book. So why did you feel the need to have that warning?
Because I'm addressing some questions that I've personally found hard to deal with, because science tells you something that you might not like. And I've been writing about this for 10, 15 years, and I get a lot of feedback to my writing. And I think a lot of people have similar problems. So I wanted to put this ahead, like it might be difficult. And I wanted people to know what they get themselves into.
Yeah, of course. So let's tackle some of these questions, such fascinating questions you've addressed in this book. Let's do the one of the first ones. Does the past still exist? So, Sabine, we are having this conversation now in this time. Listeners are hearing this conversation in, I guess, there now because we're pre-taping, pre-recording this conversation. Doesn't now exist in a way that the past and the future do not?
Well, if you trust Albert Einstein, which I think is a good person to trust, then the answer is the moment that we call now is just a meaningless human term that we give to something. It has no fundamental meaning. And that's because according to Einstein, it's impossible that everyone agrees on which moment is now. So odd as it sounds, every moment could be now for someone, and that includes the past. So your past could be somebody else's present. And why should somebody else's present be any less real than yours?
Mm-hmm. So now is meaningless. We're told so often in our society, Sabine, that now is very important. All you have is the now, and you're telling us it's meaningless. in a certain way.
Well, I'm sorry. Well, it's not that I invented this, right? I'm just telling you, this is what Einstein found. It's called the block universe. So the universe doesn't come into being, just sits there like a block already in place.
I see. So help us grasp a little bit more this fourth dimension, which you write about in the book. We have the three dimensions we know, which can be described as, I guess, height, width, and depth. But you want this fourth dimension of time. That is so hard to add to the other three. Can you help us understand how time can be another dimension together with these spatial dimensions?
So the way that we are used to think about time, it's something like a parameter. It's like something that ticks the same for all of us. So we all agree on what time it is and what the second means and that kind of stuff. So if time becomes a dimension like the other dimensions, then really the passage of time is just a matter of putting labels on a coordinate axis, like the same way you do it with space. You can put some labels there in meters or inches or what have you, but it's a matter of definition. And now once you make time into a dimension, you have the same problem. You have some labels on it, but what do those labels mean? And what Einstein found out is that the labels pretty much don't mean anything. You have to define a personal time for everybody who moves in space-time. And this is also called the proper time or Eigentime, if you want the German word. And this means that time really passes differently depending on how you move. So this was Einstein's great insight. And this is why time can slow down if you move really quickly or if you get close to a black hole, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And why does this matter to us on Earth in the 21st century?
Well, to be honest, in daily life, it doesn't really matter. It really only matters if you move at velocities that are very close to the speed of light, or more properly, at relative velocities close to the speed of light, which is something that we don't normally achieve if we walk around. So for practical purposes, we can all agree on what we mean by now and how time passes. But it does play a role, for example, for the GPS system. So we have all those satellites that are orbiting around Earth, and they send signals to the ground that you can pick up with your phone. And the phone basically does a triangulation with those signals and infers exactly where you are. But for this to properly work, you have to take into account how the timestamp coming from those satellites is distorted according to Einstein's theories. So it actually has a practical use.
Mm-hmm. Don't you make a... Yeah, there's quite a bit of humor in this book, which I enjoy, and it's coming through in this interview. But don't you have some sort of exercise, like if you would walk or run in a circle, let's say in a gymnasium, this actually... tiny degree is also the case, right?
Yeah, that's right. Technically, it would slow down time and you would age a little bit slower. That's because this happens every time you're in an accelerated motion. And so for physicists, an acceleration isn't just if you hit the gas pedal. But if you do not move in a straight line, for example, in a circle, that's also an acceleration because it changes direction. So if you run in a circle, that slows down time for you.
I'll remember that next time I run around in a circle or my dog runs around in a circle. So many questions here. If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour, theoretical physicist Sabine Hossenfelder. Her new book, Existential Physics, A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions. She's also creator of a very popular YouTube channel called Science Without the Gobbledygook. Do you know Bill Nye, by the way, Sabina? Do you know that name?
Well, I know the name. I haven't personally met him.
I've interviewed him on this program, and he's very popular in making sort of science accessible to people. And it strikes me that you may be the German version of Bill Nye. But we'll set that aside for... It's a compliment, by the way, a very big compliment, making these kind of ideas accessible to people without, for instance, a physics background. I wonder, how did you go about choosing these questions. You have, you know, do copies of us exist? Has physics ruled out free will? Does the universe think? Are humans predictable? Some of the questions you tackle in this book. How did you go about selecting the questions?
Well, this was actually pretty easy. I've been writing about the foundations of physics for quite a long time, 15 years, and I've been doing videos about it, as you've seen. And I was just wondering, like, what are the topics that people are most interested in? And it turned out it's those big questions about free will. Do we have free will? Panpsychism, can elementary particles think? How did the universe begin? How will it end? And so on and so forth. And I thought I'd just collect them all and make a book out of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's tackle another one of the questions. I want to ask you your thoughts on the question you raise in this book, how did the universe begin and how will it end? Because very recently we have the new James Webb Space Telescope in orbit, which I have to believe is a super exciting thing, especially for you. Tell us about this question and how you approached the beginning and end of our universe.
Yeah, so as you say correctly, the Webb telescope is super exciting because I presently work in astrophysics, so study the question like what is dark matter made of? Is it made of anything? Is it a particle or is it actually a misnomer and we should be talking about modification of gravity? And the Webb telescope can shed light on this question, no pun intended, by looking back into the universe to earlier galaxies than we have ever seen. And that can tell us something about how soon those galaxies formed in the early universe. And that works differently depending on what type of dark matter you have or if it's a modification of gravity. So that's very exciting. But we're still talking about fairly late times in the evolution of the universe, something like 300,000 years or something. So when we look back even before this, data becomes very, very sparse and eventually it just runs out. So what we do eventually is that we just take the equations that we have and we extrapolate them back. And what we find is that they break down at some point, and that's what we call the Big Bang. So technically, the Big Bang is a moment where the energy density in the universe was infinitely large, and most physicists, including me, think that this just means that the theory breaks down. And so this is what we reliably know. But then physicists have made up a lot of other stories about what could have happened instead of just taking the equations and conclude that they break down and that probably isn't what happens. You can tack onto this story something else. You can, for example, say, well, actually, it wasn't a big bang, but there was an earlier universe which collapsed and then it expanded again. So this is called a big bounce. And those bounces can actually repeat, giving rise to a cyclic universe, or it could be something else. We could have come out of a black hole, and it could have been, I don't mean to scare you, but it could have been a five-dimensional black hole, or it could have been a collision of higher-dimensional membranes or something with strings that string theorists like, and so on and so forth. So there are lots of stories about how the universe could have begun. And I think this, in many people's mind, you know, if they read those headlines, brings up the question, like, why do they not know? Why do they have so many different stories? Why can't they agree? What does the data say? And where the answer is, the data don't say anything about it. The data aren't good enough to tell those stories apart. And I think they never will be. It's just a way in which science is fundamentally limited.
Mm-hmm. I was very interested to watch some of your YouTube channel episodes, the Science Without the Gobbledygook. I wanted to, one in particular, ask you about, because one is titled How I Learned to Love Pseudoscience. And this is interesting because, you know, on this program, we tackle a lot of sort of anti-scientific thinking and, you know, that we think here in the U.S. and perhaps your experience, I know you've lived in the U.S. as well, you know, that we've gotten away from paying attention to science and what data tells us and really having to have claims that are backed by facts, substantiated facts. But you say you've learned to love pseudoscience. How can that be?
Well, I think I've just realized by looking at the history of science that a lot of the progress that we have made has come from trying to distinguish science from pseudoscience. And this has allowed us to improve our methods. It has sharpened our tools, so to speak. So in a certain sense, it's like, you know, you as the saying has it, where there's light, there has to be shadow. And I think that science and pseudoscience, they belong together in this way. You need something on the other side.
Mm-hmm. How do you explain the popular anti-scientific attitudes in our society, especially, I think, American society today? Climate science is a good example there. Many people don't seem to care if science backs up a claim. And also another thing I'll just add in there, would you are an academic, and being called an academic in recent years is not always meant in a positive way, is it?
Yeah, that's right. So we call this trend anti-science, but I think people aren't really against science. It's more that they don't trust scientists, or maybe they don't trust academia specifically. And, you know, to some extent, I can't really blame them, because especially if I look at my own research area on the foundations of physics, there's a lot of stuff that gets published which isn't really scientific. And I feel that to some extent, people feel that, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in science which isn't really proper science, and they feel that they can't really trust the system, but then they throw out the baby with the bathwater. So that's where the problem starts.
I was surprised you also tackled the question, does God exist? There's one that will get some passions going. How did you tackle that in a scientific way?
Well, so I think that God is just outside the realm of science. So I didn't really define what we mean by God, but I was talking about some example. For example, that God made the world 6,000 years ago. And I think there's just nothing that we have in terms of evidence that would speak against this. So it's really an idea that lies outside of science.
Mm-hmm. And I think the point you make in that episode is science concerns itself only with things that are observable. And as you just pointed out, this is not something that is observable. So you would have really no, you can't weigh in on it really in the way you do on other things.
Basically, yes. Though I think that the way that I put it was a little bit more complicated, which is that we concern ourselves with explanations for what we observe. And the reason I phrased this so carefully is that, as you probably know, in quantum mechanics, we have this issue that we describe things by way of a wave function, which is not itself observable. And then you can debate back and forth, does the wave function actually exist? And exactly what do we mean by this? But we all agree that the wave function actually describes our observations.
Mm-hmm. Science Without the Gobbledygook is your popular YouTube channel. You have subscribers, I assume, because you have more than 500,000 of them from all around the world. What interests you most in the viewers, the reactions to your book, to your writings from people around the world? Surprising reactions? Can you tell anything about our world through your lens of reactions to your writings about physics?
Well, I always find it interesting to hear what's the next thing that people are interested in. Also, I can tell from the reactions whether they understood what I was trying to get across. For example, the video which you interestingly enough just mentioned about whether God exists, and then I go on to ask, do I exist? Does the multiverse exist? I think this is something that people found very difficult to understand. And I've tried to improve on this in my book, and I have another video coming up on the multiverse where I also try to explain better what I was trying to say with that. So this feedback which I get from my viewers is super, super important to me.
Mm-hmm. Are there, as a theoretical physicist, are there questions, things that you just can't wrap your mind around at this point?
Well, one of the questions you already mentioned in the beginning is the question, does the universe think? So this is something which I'm still trying to figure out what it really means. So I've pretty much arrived at the conclusion that we can't rule it out. It might actually be possible that the universe think, and what the heck does this now mean?
Yeah, what does it mean to have a universe that thinks? And you haven't arrived at...
Exactly.
Sabina Hassenfelder, I'm just interested. This is such fascinating work, so complex to think about and then pick apart. What do you do to relax?
Well, what do I do to relax? So I like to make music, mostly on my computer, I have to admit. I sing, I write songs, make compositions. Sometimes I draw. I used to do some animations, as you've probably seen on my YouTube channel. I don't do this anymore, but I quite like doing some artistic things, I guess.
And that's your relaxation. Well, thank you very much for this conversation. We wish you all the best, and we'll look forward to more explanations to big questions. Theoretical physicist Sabina Hassenfelder, Existential Physics, A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions, her latest book. She's also creator of the YouTube channel Science Without the Gobbledygook. Sabina Hassenfelder, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the wonderful conversation.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's it for today. Our program, River to River, today produced by Samantha McIntosh. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.